We now go to a poem by Marge Piercy and read by Cynthia. Cynthia is from the seacoast. She's a librarian and an active citizen who believes in the power of words to reach into people's conscience and sense of justice. And she's been reading a poem for us each week in April to celebrate National Poetry Month. So let's go to her now for our last poem of April.
This poem is Choices by Marge Piercy from Wellfleet, Massachusetts. It's in Poets Against the War, edited by Sam Hamill, from Thunder's Mouth Press, 2003. Choices. Would you rather have health insurance you can actually afford, or bomb Iraq? Would you rather have enough inspectors to keep your kids from getting poisoned by bad hamburgers, or bomb Iraq? Would you rather breathe clean air and drink water free from pesticides and upriver, or bomb Iraq? We're the family in debt whose kids need shoes and to go to the dentist, but we spend our cash on crack, an explosion in our heads, or many on the TV. Where's the bigger thrill? It's money blowing up in those weird green lights, money for safety, money for schools and Head Start. Oh, we love fetuses now. We even dote on embryos the size of needle tips. But people, who needs them? Collateral damage. Babies, kids, goats and tabby cats, old women sewing, old men praying. They'll become smoke and blow away like sandstorms of the precious desert covering treasure. Let's go conquer more oil and dirty the air and choke our lungs till our insides look like stinky residue in an old dumpster. More dead people is obviously what we need, some of theirs, some of ours. After they're dead a while, strip them and it's hard to tell the difference.
I've been thinking about how to talk about I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about the greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. Greed is a poison rising in this land. The soul of the people twisted in its command. It moves like a virus, seeking out everyone. Greed never stops his work, it never ever done. A creeping, choking, killing, invading everywhere. There is really no escaping greed's sneaky snare. I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. Not partial to gender or your sexual desires. All it wants is for you to want to own, to possess, and to buy. Nothing seems to stop it once it enters your soul. Has you buying anything, spending out of control? It moves within the culture, touching us all. Greed really isn't picky, it'll make anybody fall. I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. It's been around a long time since before we began. Before this was a nation, greed drove people to this land. Greed-driven men created slavery. Black men, women, and children became somebody's property. Greed is a strand in the American dream. Having more than you need exactly what I mean. You don't really wanna know about you're in my greed. You may wonder whether you're infected by greed. If you have to ask, then this song you really need. Greed is sneaky, hard to detect in myself. I see it so clearly in everybody else. I've been trying to find a way to talk about greed. I've been trying to find a way to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. Now I can see it in you. You can see it in me. We can see it in big corporations all throughout the government. See it in the banks. I can see it in the military. See it in the church. I can see it in my neighbor. It all shows up so clearly. You and you and your greed. I've been trying to find a way to talk about greed. I've been trying to find a way to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. I'm trying to find a way to talk about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed.
Trying to find a way to talk about greed. Dum, 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 dum. Trying to find a way to talk about greed.
For Making Waves Radio, I'm Brian Gregg. Up next, a talk by Jim Merkel, author of Radical Simplicity from New Society Publishers. Jim was here in Portsmouth on Earth Day, April 22nd, at the River Run Bookstore to talk about his book. He was a military engineer who quit his job after the Exxon Valdez disaster and has since devoted his life to developing tools for personal and societal sustainability. He founded the Global Living Project to further this work and conducts workshops around North America.
Imagine you are at a potluck buffet and see that you are the first in line. How do you know how much to take? Imagine that this potluck spread includes not just food and water, but also the materials needed for shelter, clothing, healthcare, and education. It all looks and smells so good, and you are hungry. What will you heap on your plate? How much is enough to leave for your neighbors behind you in the line? Now extend this cornucopia to today's global economy, where the necessities for life come from around the world. 6 billion people, shoulder to shoulder, form a line that circles the globe to Cairo, onto Hawaii, over ocean bridges, then back and around the globe again 180 more times. Just humans. We circle the earth 180 times with plates in hand. Those behind you, yeah, they too wait in line, hearty appetites in place, and along with them are giraffes and clip springers, manatees and spiders, untold millions of species, millions of billions of unique beings, all with the same lusty appetites. And behind them are the soon-to-be-born children, cubs, and larvae. A harmonious feast just might be possible, but it requires a bit of restraint, or shall we say a tamed appetite, as our plate becomes a shopping cart, becomes a pickup truck, filling our home, attic, basement, garage, and maybe even a rented storage unit, with nature transformed into things. As we sit down for a good hearty meal with new friends and creatures from around the world, what level of equity would we feel really great about? At what level of inequity would we say, wait a minute, that's not fair? And if you look at the first billion on that line, that potluck line of 6.4 billion of us, we get about an average of $70 a day in our pocket to meet our needs. That's the richest billion on planet Earth, and I'm one of those. On average, $70 a day. The poorest billion have 25 cents a day. And they have to do the things we have to do. Eat, clothing, shelter, education, healthcare, all those things. So try to imagine yourself with 25 cents a day. And that's all you have. And there's a billion people like that on Earth. That's one out of six of us, roughly. And it's pretty intense. That's a 250-to-1 level of inequity. And I call that radical inequity. And that's why I think we need radical simplicity. We really do. And 700 million of those billion have stunted growth or mental retardation from lack of caloric intake. And then in the richest billion, 60% are overweight. We spend 40 billion on diets to reduce our caloric consumption. So that kind of insanity is really, I think, something that we're paying attention to. I feel people are paying attention to. And I'm looking for us to pay, you know, just see how can we work together to make this world a little more fair, more compassionate. And, so that's what the book is about, is really how do you see those last billion in the line? Because the line is 180 times around. How can we see it? We can't really look over our shoulder and see it. But there's a tool called the ecological footprint. And I've been working with this since 1996. When we founded this project, there's little brochures up here, the Global Living Project in British Columbia in 1996. We started measuring our own ecological footprint. Okay, and it was just coming out around 1994, this idea. University professor Dr. William Rees, the department head for community and regional planning at UBC, that's a university with 40,000 students, it's a huge university, he's department head, he came up with this idea of ecological footprint. While I got turned on to him, he was the first guy I ever saw stand up and talk about the C word in front of large groups of people. The C word, consumption. We didn't hear about consumption in the 90s that much. You would hear about, oh, those polluters are doing this, and oh, you know, the globalization, which is all true, but it's always pointing the finger at the demon, and the three fingers coming back at us are the weirder ones consuming. The environmentalists often use their car as much as the average person, and their car usually gets about the same miles per gallon as the average person. So some people say, oh, you're talking to the converted. I don't really even consider myself converted. I've got a long way to go. And I've been living on $5,000 a year for 16 years. And I am still, if I look at what would be sustainable on Earth with 6 billion of us, it's probably around $500 a year. That would be sustainable. The average of all humanity in terms of GNP is $5,000 a year. If we were to split GNP at globally equally, we'd each get $5,000. But then if you just ask yourself, who thinks the total economic consumption on planet Earth could be sustained indefinitely? And of course, our common sense says, of course not. Well, what if you cut the total global economic activity in half? Would Earth be sustainable indefinitely? In half. Most people I've asked kind of don't think so. You know, their gut sense. No, I don't think we'll be. Are grizzlies not going to face extinction? We have 200 species a day becoming extinct. Would we eliminate species extinction due to humanity's pressure by going in half? Well, what if you go to a quarter? And I've asked this question to a lot of audiences, and where they usually, their gut sense says, is somewhere around a quarter to an eighth we'd have to reduce. Quarter to an eighth of 5,000, you're getting down into 500, you know, dollars a year would be almost an equitable slice of GNP or global consumption if we want to have sustainability indefinitely. And the only reason this got so nuts is because in 35 years ago, we had the first Earth Day, and they were saying all the same things. They were burying an engine, like some college students buried an engine in some plaza, a car engine, saying, we got to bury this. It's a dinosaur. But we're still using it. And that was in 1970. We were on to all this stuff. And so, you know, we've built the house of cards a little higher each year of unsustainability. Daniel Quinn wrote a recent essay, and he says, what would happen if you're extincting 200 species a day? So you get up to the 100th floor of a building, and then every day you go downstairs to take out 200 bricks. Go back up to your little high-rise, little apartment and take 200 bricks the next day. You can't take 200 species a day and keep doing this. So he says he doesn't know the answer, Daniel Quinn says, in this little essay. It's probably kind of fun one. Someone emailed it to me, but we know we can't keep doing that. And if we don't change, we're going to make a real mess for ourselves and our kids. So he's like, well, what are we going to do? He's more leaving it up to us to figure out those big answers. And I don't claim to have any big answers, but I think the equity piece is key. And the looking at the global sustainability piece is key. And we didn't have tools like the ecological footprint before 1993, really. So now we can see the end of the line. It's real easy. We know how much earth there is. You take away the deserts, oceans, and ice caps, there's about 28 billion acres of land. You divide it by 6.4 billion people. We each get a slice of bioproductive earth of about 4.6 acres. That's what we each get. But that's not leaving space for any other species. It's just humanity taking the whole ecological enchilada. So then if we want to leave earth for the other species enough, then we back down again. If we want to leave 80% of the earth for the other 25 million estimated species, we're set to live on 1 acre. And right now in the U.S. we live on about 24. 24 acres per person is how much land is needed to sustain our lifestyle. So that's to grow your bananas over there, to get your oil from here, to the resource to build your car, for everything, for our electronics, our insurance. It's like adding up all the things we consume. There needs to be earth somewhere to supply those things. And when you add it up, it comes to 24 acres per person in the U.S. But Europeans have equivalent lifestyle on half the footprint. And that's where it gets exciting. Okay, then Mexico has half the footprint of Europe and a little lower life quality. And then you go to, say, China's about 4, India's about 2. And now our Global Living Project was measuring our footprint with teams of researchers since 1996. And we've done it 5 experiments, kind of like where they send educators to the moon for them to see what it's like. So we send educators to our project, 15 of them, and they try to live as a global citizen, as one of 6.4 billion people. And what they have been able to do, 5 teams now, to live on 3 acres, less than a person from China and just above a person from India. And they report their quality of life is better than it is at home. And we've repeated this experiment 5 times. So right now, our original question was, is it possible to live equitably and harmoniously within the means of nature? The answer for us is yes, it is possible. But so the next question is, well, what will it take us to generate the will to do it? And that's what I'm out here about.
You're listening to Making Waves with Jim Merkel, author of Radical Simplicity.
So the best ways that we found, the highest technology ways that we found of really reducing our footprint is, one is sharing. Very high-tech approach, but it's sharing. And the second, really, you need cutting-edge technology, but to care. As you care for something. So you share your car with one other person, you have its ecological footprint. You share it with 4 people, you quarter its footprint. Well, we would have 15 people getting into a 15-passenger van sometimes. So you're 1/15th the footprint if you were to take that trip alone. Then you care for something, so you make it last twice as long. If your house lasts twice as long, you have its footprint. Your car lasts twice as long. Your bicycle, you lock it so it doesn't get stolen, you have its footprint if it lasts twice as long. Then if you conserve, okay, so let's stick with the car. So you share with one person, you have its footprint. You make it last twice as long. You're down to 1/4. Then you get a car that gets twice the miles per gallon. So now you're to 1/8. Now you get very good at making lists. And so you combine trips and you bike a little bit. You conserve. Sharing, caring, conserving. And then you cut your trips in half, your miles traveled in half. So now you're to 1/16. And you haven't done ecological heroics yet. You know what I'm saying? You haven't went out and bought the most expensive hybrid. You just get a car that gets double the miles per gallon. So you can repeat this with your home, with possessions you own. You can share tools in your community. If you just keep thinking of those three things, sharing, caring, conserving, you can make quantum reduction. Like 20% reduction isn't going to get us where we have to get, right? But 20 timer, when we just said 1/16th of the car, that's significant. That's significant. So those are some of the tools. So I'll talk a little bit more about the three tools are in your money in this book, Radical Simplicity. So one is how to do your own footprint. So I have the spreadsheets in here. I have three methods. One is 12 questions. It'll take you about 15 minutes to do it. Let me back up. And the first method is take you 5 minutes. It's your income correlates more strongly than anything to your footprint. The more money we earn on average, the more we spend. And then that's the biggest indicator, simple, easiest. Your income is correlated to your footprint very strongly. Second is the 12 questions. How big is your house? How many people do you share with? How fuel efficient is your car? What kind of diet choices? So car is the biggest. Housing is usually the second. Heating it is third. How many square foot? And then your diet choice, eating higher on the food chain, and just how much you consume in general, how much you waste in general. So that's the second method. The third is a 100-item spreadsheet. And that's what we did with our project since 1996, is a very detailed accounting of our footprint, a very robust scientific method. And then we had this Dr. Matisse Wackernagel got his PhD in footprinting from Dr. William Rees at the University of British Columbia. Matisse puts together this report each year with World Wildlife Fund, and he's got UN funding to calculate the footprint of 150 nations every year. So this is done. So we have data since 1996, and we can compare our footprint to people around the world. And so the nice thing about using footprints is you really have some way of comparing. So you can see, these are all the nations across here, and shows their footprint in many different categories. So it's quite a neat thing. It's grown since 1996. I don't have offhand. The footprint is growing a little each year. Yeah, our impact slightly growing. So, but I'll leave that around for people to see later. And then the third tool I include in here is learning directly from nature. And nature, you don't need a teacher, right? And you don't really even need a book. You can get some field guides, and that's really helpful and stuff. But for me, I don't know if you ever found this, but if you just spend a lot of time alone out in nature, you just start seeing things and feeling and intuiting what are the needs of other species. It just becomes intuitive to you. Like Native American people they were so in tune with nature, they knew intuitively what was going on around them. They couldn't describe to you why they would make a decision, because they were taking in hundreds and hundreds of inputs. And then from all those inputs, they would have an idea of what might happen tomorrow. But they couldn't describe it to you. It'd just be too complicated. If you were to try to model it, I'm a recovering engineer, it would be such an you couldn't model it. There was no way. And they're that wisdom. So we can have that wisdom too. But I think we have to, if you spend 5 years in a university, perhaps 5 years out with your feet on Mother Earth, without a teacher, without books, just time alone, away from other people, away, leave your dog at home even. Your dog, you can have a sense of smell as good as your dog if you develop it. But if you let your dog smell everything for you. So that's the third tool. And I think with those three, I didn't talk about the third one. Your money or your life. So footprinting, learning from nature, and then your money or your life. Who's heard of that book, Your Money or Your Life? It was national bestseller. And I got off the treadmill in 1989 after the Valdez oil spill. I saw that on the TV. I was selling arms to foreign militaries. I was an arms dealer for the U.S. government, selling top secret cryptographics. I was in Stockholm, Sweden. The Valdez oil spill came on the TV, and I was drinking my Belgian dark beer, and I just started to cry when I saw the oil spill. Because I always had this feeling of wilderness in my bones, and then I saw this place just totally soaked in oil. And I knew I had to change, but I didn't know how to do it. So when I got home, I started riding my bike to work every day, first off, because it hit me that hard. But it took me a full year to figure out what to do. I locked myself in my house, and I said, what do I need? I was making $45,000 a year at the time, in 1989 as an engineer. I said, what do I need? And I mapped it out. I said, if I rent 3 of the 4 bedrooms, take the car off the road, and plant a garden, I figured out I could live on $5,000 a year. Then I looked at my assets, and I realized I had enough assets at age 30 to live the rest of my life off the interest from what I had earned by the age of 30 if I lived on $5,000 a year. So I went in on Monday and gave my notice. And that was 16 years ago. So I haven't touched my capital in 16 years. I've just lived off the interest and done all volunteer work for 16 years. And so people would ask me when I'd show up to 10 public meetings a week. I became what they called in the newspaper in San Luis Obispo, California, professional thorn in the side. That was my favorite title. People say, how do you attend all these meetings? And then I tell them, well, I just live on the interest from what I earned as an engineer. And they say, well, you should write a book. Then I found this book, Your Money, Your Life. And I said, wow, I don't have to write that. And then I met the authors. I came back from India and I said, I want to meet these folks in Seattle. And I met them and they were all walking their talk. It was a group of 10 or 12 people who wrote this book together, and they were all living on between $5,000 and $10,000 a year in an expensive city in Seattle. And doing it. And their life didn't look any different in mainstream life if you go into their house, but they were just being wise. That's all they were doing. And they became really good friends. And Vicki Robin is really one of my mentors in life. So that's the third tool in here. And why I think it's so powerful is because everything we consume has an impact on the earth. Every time we spend a dollar, we're consuming Mother Earth. That dollar has oil in it. Every dollar has oil in it. And maybe from 20% to 80% of that dollar is oil. You know, your cereal, I had this image in my book of who you dump out your cereal, a little prize comes out, and it's a crude soaked cormorant, you know. It flops into your cereal bowl, you know. But so those are the three tools. And now I want to do a little reading. I went to Kerala, India in 1993. I applied for this fellowship. And Kerala is this interesting place, southern state of India. They live on $365 a year GMP, and yet they have infant mortality rate 5 times less than the rest of India. And long lives, education is free to the second year of college, more women enrolled in college than men, 60% of public spending is on education and health care. And they just do amazing things. So I went there as a researcher and lived with the family. And I'll just read the first little paragraph because it's funny for me anyway. In Bombay, I fly in 2 a.m. I'm lying in bed with a man I met an hour ago. In the dark, we are talking about life. How did I get here? Well, the young woman seated beside me on the plane invited me home to get 6 hours of sleep before continuing on to Kerala. After a word with her dad at the baggage claim, he put his arm around me as if I were his son and walked me to their car. As the family reunion, wound down, bed space was offered with her brother, a mechanical engineer my own age. India's hospitality was immediately revealed, but I had come to learn about sustainability. Yeah, that was a fun night. I just couldn't believe it, man. We're staring at the ceiling in this bed that's just hard as a rock and just talking about life, you know. It was just so, I couldn't even believe it. And that kind of stuff happened over and over again in India. They told me our guests are our gods. That's what they say in India. And they really did mean it. I slept lightly from the heat and excitement, but woke refreshed and went out for an exquisite vegan breakfast. To eat low on the food chain here is the norm. Most Indians are vegetarian, although fish and meat are eaten by some. Afterwards, I walked the village pathways, a tropical paradise that with a crowded 20th century edge that lessened as I ventured into the hills. On a bluff, I looked down at the next beach away from the tourists. The children played naked in the water. Men loaded nets onto double-ender oar-powered boats. Women filled urns from a fountain and carried them home on their heads. 3 men gathered coconuts. The one in the tree sliced the nuts and green fronds free with a machete. On the ground, another one gathered the nuts and fronds into piles. The third one made sure no one got bonked. Across the street, six women sat together in the shade and wove the dried fronds into panels, a sizable stack taking form. I didn't have to move to see the entire process. The raw materials, green fronds, were pruned, gathered, and aged in the shade till brown, then exported across the street to be woven. The finished panels formed a roof here, home siding there, and a small bath hut around the back. A few were exported to the beach to shade the nets, boats, or tourists, and to the village entrance to shade the women breaking rocks. Old decayed panels were used to mulch the ground, building soil and reducing erosion. Forward-thinking Europeans have formulated a business policy which holds manufacturers responsible for their products from cradle to grave. Here, there is no grave. What designer William McDonough refers to as cradle to cradle, waste equals food. There are no clear cuts, no factories, no fossil fuels, no insurance, and no marketing. These processes took only the fruits and pruned fronds. For 6 years, I was a process engineer in a high-tech factory in New York and designed manufacturing systems. Now I was in a real-world sustainable living factory. I linked yesterday's spun coconut fibers to today's freed nuts. I had seen husks go into the fire to heat a curry pot at the restaurant and tasted the coconut milk and meat in two meals. Fuel, food, shelter, fishing nets, ropes, all from one tree, and they never killed the tree. It's like, whoa. I used to work in California. Whoa, dude. Like, that's impressive, you know? Wow. And so that kind of thinking really stimulated. Of course, here in North America, we're not going to repeat what we see in Kerala. But, wow, what can we do? We're so creative. We have so much technology. We have so much information. We have such big hearts that just want to do the right thing. Couple all this together to create a beautiful, sustainable, really sane, wholesome world. Like, wow. Like, that's fun. You know? Like, let's do it. You know, so when I came back from India, that's when we founded this Global Living Project. And that kind of gave me the belief that this is possible. I've seen it. I'm the kind of engineer, I don't do so good with books. But if I see it, you know, and say as an engineer, if I was asked in my job, can you reduce the waste from some process? I was a process engineer for a while, by 10%. Oh, I'd say sure. If the boss asked me to reduce it by 10 times, can you do it? Oh, sure. It's just a different problem. Like my boss used to say, go out on the factory floor and drift for a month or two and just look, watch. And then he said, come back. I want something we can invest money in that will have a 6-month payback. 6 months, that's 200% return on your investment. I'd go around and find 5 or 10 projects like that. You just take your time, slow, and look. And if he wants 20% return, you can get 20% return. You want 200, you get 200. It's just what you ask an engineer, they're kind of arrogant sometimes. I was a very arrogant engineer. I thought we could engineer the world to be sustainable. We can't. You rip a leaf in half and all the engineers in the world can't put it together. We really don't know much. But we do know how to do some things pretty good. And if you challenge an engineer with a really hard problem, they love it. And a lot of us like challenge. So if like I had to design this little top secret cryptographic box. At 27 years old, a senior designer, it had to work underwater, a full computer, working underwater by a skin diver. So sealed, had to operate on the deck of a battleship with that big powerful radar. It was top secret, so it had to be able to send messages through public telephones and not be busted. And you couldn't understand it. Top secret cryptographics, and then it was nuclear hardened, so every component could survive a nuclear blast. At 27, I designed this stupid thing. That's only making the world worse, you know? But I loved it, like, because I was not conscious that my life should contribute to something positive at the time, but just the challenge of that was so much fun, because it was hard, and it was challenging, and there was 25 of us working as a team to make it happen. Well, what if all of us here in this room said after the end of the night, let's close the door and say, Tom, we're taking over your store for the night. We're going to stay up, and he's going to brew another pot of coffee, and we're going to figure out how to make our town sustainable, or our life, or our little community, or something, we could put our minds together. In this room, we'd have so many skills if we pulled them together. It would be mind-boggling. You know, that we'd have every skill we would need sitting in this room to make this world, our town, sustainable, to really make it happen. And I think when I compare, you know, Rowan and I working to make our own little life sustainable down to 3 acres, our daily life is around 3 acres. The work and energy required is not as much as difficult of an engineering challenge as that little box is. It really wasn't. But the harder part, the technology we've had for 10,000 years of how to live simply. All the other species know how to do it. Teachers are all around us of how to live simply. But the hardest part is to say no to what is so easy to have. You know, it's really tough. You know, and it's really, really tough. You go to youth hostel and you put a pin wherever you come from. So the pins are all from north of the hemisphere, right? There's no pins from people come to the youth hostel traveling the world. There's like one pin from the southern hemisphere. Well, why? Because they got $300 a year. They may save for 10 years or 20 years or once in a lifetime of flight. But that stuff for us, we could just do it every year. We just have the money and it's so easy. So to me, that's a really tough part of it. Is to culturally do what's not common around us is tricky, to step out of the box. And so it is tough. I think the harder part is also is the interpersonal part, because we used to have a lot more community. And I heard a speaker two or three years ago, I was at a big conference, and he says, if you were just to think of all of us here in North America and say, do you think we act as a culture like children, like adolescents, like young adults, like grown-ups, or like wise elders? What would you say? Infants and... Well, at this conference, everyone said it like adolescents. I don't know. And adolescence, that's when you're me. You know, you're the center of the universe. And we all should be when we're 17 or 18. We're the center of the universe. But then our culture still is at the center of the universe forever in our culture. So it's that maturing which we're begging for. And, you know, that wisdom of our elders. And, so we go from the me to the we. That me to we is really what we're after. And I think that's even harder right now than the how to design a little straw bale house, or, you know, how to ride the bike. We all know how, or how to move closer to work, you know, just when we choose where you're going to live, make sure it's close to shopping, close to your family, close to work. And, you know, those are choices. They're big choices, but yeah, so one of the major inspirations for me about writing this book was to help people who want to really participate in a better world to get off the treadmill of working. A lot of us may have jobs that are really making the world a better place. Like your job is restoring the earth. Every day you go into work, the earth is a little better by the end of your day being there, because the work you're doing is restoring the planet to a more healthy planet. And a lot of us, like my job for all those years, was making the earth worse every day. And some of us may have those jobs. And for me, a huge emphasis of this book and my writing is no guilt, no shame, no blame, none of that, because it just poisons us. You know, it's no jumping up on our horse or nothing. It's really just saying, you know, like I like the bumper sticker says, I am polluting. I am changing the climate. Ask me how. You know, just be honest, like relax. You know, don't beat yourself up. We've done enough of that, beating ourselves up, but just be honest. And then let's just work together. We can be honest and just work together you may not do it this year, but next year. And part of this living simply is as you consume less, you need to work less. As you work less, you have more free time. Then you can contribute more to all those things that you are so passionate about. You can have more time with your friends and family, your children. That's what they want. They don't want new things. We all know that. They want your time. They want quality. They want connection. They're hungry for everything almost everything we consume today. There's a spiritual replacer for that material. And the material still doesn't even fill the void. But we think, oh, I should give my kids more than I had. But it never does it. The Beatles told us, can't buy me love, right? Money can't buy me love. You know, yeah, they get their money. Yeah, but they knew. They knew the truth, and it kind of rings when we hear the truth that money can't buy love. We know it.
And that was Jim Merkel, author of Radical Simplicity, speaking in Portsmouth at the River Run Bookstore on Earth Day, April 22nd.
There's a song that calls the salmon home, a song that calls the eagles. It's a song that only silence brings, a song that stirs the dreamer. Watching for the eagle, traveling on the turtle's back, searching for the healer.
That was Irish group Different Drums of Ireland with Salmon Song by Roy Arbuckle. Now we hear Wash Your Spirit Clean, which is a song done by Walela, a Cherokee group of women.
Inagala chata na to
Thanks for joining us today on Making Waves. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Brian Gregg, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Dino Pappas, Joanne Paradise, Jeff White, and Damon Thomas. We welcome and need your participation too. Please contact us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com. And let us know you want to help or what you think of our show. To hear previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. You can also live stream our show on Saturdays 2 to 4 if you are not in range of the station, by going to www.wirenh.com/radio. Remember that WSCA is new and growing and hoping for your membership and your participation. Go to www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. And we leave you with this quote. To forget how to dig the earth and tend the soil is to forget ourselves. Gandhi.